Hi everyone, my name is Patrick Akio, and if you're interested in programming language, different work cultures, and finding personal fulfillment, this episode is for you. Joining me today, my friend, my colleague, Abdullah Zaiter. He's a software consultant over here at Xebia, and he does mentorship. He's a software engineering mentor over at adplist.org. I'll put all his socials in the description below. Check him out, let him know you came from our show. And with that being said, enjoy this episode. Beyond coding. So what I always wonder is, because I pitch projects that I've been on for like someone that's going to come on that project, right? And I can still be there, but sometimes I have to leave to a different project. So I pitched Action to you. I don't know how anything came across or like if it was what I said it was going to be, but how was kind of that experience? Were you glad that you joined Action, or was it, did I kind of sell it to you too much?
Yeah. So answering the last question.
Let's start with that.
Okay. Yeah. Am I glad I joined Action? For sure. 100%.
That's
experience
good.
Is, I would say, one of the most significant technically to pick a project that is selling well in one country, but then make it work in another country, expand it, and then the other country have different languages, and then it involves different laws, different tax types, different challenges. And yeah, at first when you pitched it to me, I was like, whoa, everybody's leaving the project and now this is on my plate.
Yeah.
And we actually, I don't know if you remember, we had that discussion about it, the project having front end.
Yeah,
and
no, I know.
Like, oh boy, I'm a back end engineer. I don't know this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But then you're like, yeah, let's see. I think we'll get over it. But overall, yeah, it was nice. And you repeated the word crashing the KPIs like three times in that pitch.
Okay. I don't remember exactly what I said.
Yeah. But yeah, overall, it was and it is still being a really nice experience.
Yeah. I like it as a project a lot, actually, because things were simplistic enough to kind of grasp pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And I felt like I could add value really quickly as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So sometimes you have the deadline part of it. So commitment to stakeholders, they were expecting something, and then changes in the structure of the people in the project happen. And then I would say the challenges in this kind of situation are not really with the technical part. So of course I didn't know a lot of front end, but I didn't feel at any moment that I was struggling because of front end.
Yeah.
The bigger challenge was managing expectation and then making it work for their deadline to launch in Belgium.
Yeah.
And this is the challenge. And in every consultancy work, you'll have this kind of challenge, right? That's the idea of consultancy.
Yeah. But sometimes it's a technology challenge. You're like, I don't know what is happening. I don't know how React works. Like, you have to dive into the technology and really get a fundamental understanding. And I felt like things were very simplistic, and therefore you could add value pretty quickly. Like, even though with minimal front end knowledge, I feel like you could get stuff done just by looking at how things were done in the first place. And then kind of, retracing those steps and doing it as well. Or otherwise calling Hernani and being like, help me out.
Shout out to Hernani. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
I've called him many times on the same project. Yeah, that's always a lot of fun.
No, it's actually funny because I think some days ago we had a new situation with a front end thing.
Yeah.
And I was involved in many operational problems, you know, like answering legal stuff, compliance. And then I was like, okay, guys, the other team members, okay, guys, I can't really enter this technical issue and really help now.
Yeah.
Because there are these other topics, but here's Hernani's contact. Here is Hernani's contact, and please talk to him. He knows a lot about front end. And then I send him a message. He's like, "Yeah, Action again, of course."
Yeah, then, exactly.
Yeah.
But he probably helped them out.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Yeah, good stuff, man. Good guy. One of the questions I had is, because I saw your background, and you have, like, I don't know if you've done C++, but definitely like Kotlin and the JVM stack, and then you went to Go. And the first time I had that, I also pitched a Go project to someone. And they were really enthusiastic. And I don't know if that's about my pitch or the language or any of the project details. But in any case, after a few months, they said, I don't like the language. I want to run away. Like, this is not for me. I miss things I had in other languages. And I've always thought that was kind of odd. And I get it, because some people really love the language they write in. I'm just not the same. Like, what was your experience moving to Go in that way and using it in production?
Yeah. First things first, I wouldn't say I moved into Go. I would say I'm using Go.
Yeah.
So I'm using Go now. It doesn't mean that I don't use Kotlin in my side projects. Doesn't mean that I don't use C and C++ in my embedded IoT project at home.
Yeah.
So yeah, for me, it wasn't really a big deal. It still isn't. I like the simplicity of Go. And coming from many compiled languages background, like C, C++, I got to understand Go pretty easily and how things work in Go.
Yeah.
And it's totally different than how JVM would be done. So I can understand the frustration of someone who only wrote Kotlin and Java, JVM-based languages their whole life, and then having to switch to Go.
Yeah, that was the case.
Yeah, and then it might be tricky. And then you can use your word, which is literally move to Go. It's not like using one extra tool anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah. So for me, it was really nice. It's one more programming languages that I'm using.
Yeah.
Having the background of compiled languages helped a lot.
Yeah.
And I don't think I regret it.
I mean, I like Go as well because it's simplistic, but it's also one of the first languages I got to use in production. So then I don't know if it's kind of always been this kind of honeymoon phase that I keep extending, or if I actually like the language because of the language specificities and stuff like that. Like I have a hard time figuring out which one is which. But in any case, I like the language, so I'll kind of stick to it.
So now a question. Can you think of a project or an application in which you think, okay, I don't think I would pick Golang for this and I would go for a JVM language?
I mean, then I might not even... So first of all, I don't think I know what the benefits are of JVM languages versus Go. I don't think I have a good grasp on that. But when it comes to custom versus something off the shelf, like if I were to have a startup and I would have an e-commerce thing and I would sell something, I don't know if I would use something that I would write myself or just get like a Shopify thing and get up and running faster like that. That is the only way where I would be like, okay, but then it's like custom versus off the shelf.
Yeah.
Yeah. But language wise, I don't know what I would really like use a JVM language for versus Go in that way. Do you have a good example for that?
I wouldn't say a very, very good or clear example, but for me now, getting work, like getting enough time of production work with Go and having worked with JVM before, I would say when your business logic and business rules really get hairy and complicated and more detailed, JVM languages tend to be really, like, they were made for that.
Okay.
So when you have a simple project, for example, when we talk about Action, of course, it's a very significant project, but the flows themselves, the business logic itself is e-com, which is logic-wise pretty common.
It's established, yeah.
Yeah. And in that specific project, we built things in a way that it doesn't need a lot of complexity. It was simplicity first.
Yeah.
But then if you talk about more complex system like payment processing and detecting frauds, detecting risks, and not talking about the performance side of it, but really the business logic side of it, I would say JVM languages can be really nice to use in this kind of case because they provide a tool set that is built to support these kind of very deep, complex business logics.
Interesting.
Meanwhile, in Go, I think it's more to solve things in a nice and simple way and then a fast way.
Yeah, it could be. But what about the toolbox makes it so that you can leverage complex business logic better in that language?
Yeah, so there are many concepts in object orientation, for example, that you try to mimic them in Go, but you don't really have them, like inheritance, different kinds of default implementation for arguments, default implementation for interfaces, actually, also in Kotlin. And this kind of stuff ends up handy when you have different business logic complexities and situations. Meanwhile, in Go, even the most simple error handling is like the pure if error else do this or do that, which is simple, easy to understand. But when your business logic grows a lot, you can have like nested error checking or like lots of if error for every step, which can look nice in another language.
Yeah, interesting.
Can look nicer in another language.
With those kind of examples, I would love to see the both sides of things, right? Because then you can have one way, or you think of one way how to do it in Go, but maybe there's another way as well, or maybe you can decompose it and make it simpler even so. Yeah. So that might be a nice blog post actually to figure out like then what the differences are and when to use which in which instance, or what you can leverage from a language versus not the other language.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you have a Go guru, they might have even have their own magic ways into approaching these problems, like that object orientation stuff that doesn't exist in Go, for example, or error handling in a way that is more straightforward and easy to read.
I thought you were going to use elegant.
Yeah, elegant.
A lot of people use that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I like that a lot, actually. I mean, it's the language that I've used for the longest. And I feel like it's more comfortable for me to pick up that language and be effective and add business value than kind of learn a new language, because you also have technical challenges with regards to that. And I feel more comfortable with it, not just because of the language, but because of the value I can add, right? Like I know how fast I'm going to be. I know exactly kind of what needs to be done. And then it's more so figuring out business logic, what actually we need to do in this domain. And I can do multiple versions of it. I can iterate faster. And then I think the end result of that would be better, hopefully. That's the idea.
Yeah. So when you are, from what I hear from you, when you are put in a project, using Go will make your time to market much shorter because you know it a lot. This is very suitable for kinds of projects in which you really need to go fast and in which you really want to don't lose the opportunity of the market, because you want to put it live and you are the only developer. But I have very good examples. So for example, in Jordan, I worked there for some time in the past, and you have always to take into consideration what is the country you are in and what is the market you are in proposes in developers. .NET there is the biggest thing. So if you decide that tomorrow, okay, I'm gonna write my application in Go, and Patrick, for example, leaves, you might spend 6 months trying to find another Patrick who writes Go to complete what Patrick started, even in a fast way. But people there use mostly .NET and JVM languages. So of course, in the Netherlands, there are many Go programmers, and in Europe, but if I am in another place, I would have a different approach in choosing my language, even if I knew Go. So if I am now in Jordan and I know Go, I would choose JVM or .NET because I know that this product must live after I leave.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I like that answer also because as a consultancy company, that is what you should take into account, right? If you build a project and we build it as consultants, somebody needs to go back into the organization. And if they don't have the expertise of the technologies you've used, either you need to teach it to them and take them with you, or you need to choose something that they already use so it can organically grow back into the organization.
Exactly.
I think that's the best answer. It's mostly using what your organization already can leverage in knowledge that they have, because otherwise you need to upskill, and that is can be expensive.
Or hire people and train them.
Yeah, which is even more expensive.
Strict deadlines.
Yeah.
Seems familiar.
it seems definitely familiar. I mean, time to market is always a factor, right? It's interesting that you use that as an argument as well, because I feel like somehow in every organization that I am, there's always deadlines, and somehow someone always says, okay, this is the deadline. And then there's always a question of, okay, is it really a deadline? But sometimes it's really a deadline. And then speed is really something you need to leverage. And I think building blocks, things you can get off the shelf, are really going to help with that. And then obviously the tool that you're most comfortable with, barring that it can fit into the organization and the ecosystem as well.
Of course,
is then what you leverage, I feel like. Then it's also bringing up the question, like, how can a new language kind of get a foot in the door then? Because if you use what is established, makes sense, because then it can grow organically. Software is a long-term game. But then let's say if there's a new language, even Go is kind of new-ish, Rust is newer. There's not a lot of new languages. They're all kind of tens of years old, but we call that new.
Mojo.
I've never heard of that.
No.
No.
They
we'll
call
play
it
around
the,
with after.
Yeah. The Python killer, they call it.
Is it?
Yeah. It started maybe.
I've also heard of Julia and some other options.
No, Julia is more than 10 years, I think. Yeah.
But in any case, how does a new language then kind of get established in the first place? Because I don't think that changes much.
Well, I think for every language, like, of course, you can expand in the future and be multi-purpose language, but you need to solve some niche.
Mm.
So you can be, it even applies to people. Like, if you want to grow and get credibility and get trust, probably you need to know something very well. And I think languages can have the same logic. So if I would, I know it's kind of funny, but if I would propose a programming language tomorrow, I would think about, okay, what is something specific in a niche that I would like to solve?
Yeah.
And then based on that, I would study different types of programming languages that started recently and why did they succeed. So for example, Go. I would pick Groovy, for example, which is, I don't think it's that old and it's like, it's taking off. And I would see, okay, how, what was their plan? What did they solve first and how did they expand? So also Python, for example. And based on that, I think the idea of a new programming languages can happen. I think Mojo, for example, I looked at it pretty recently. They are creating a programming languages that would solve the type issue in Python.
Yeah.
Which is, okay, seems nice. They have a niche. They're trying to do it. I don't know if it will take off, but it is definitely a way to sell your programming language.
Interesting. Yeah. Do you pick up or try out new languages like frequently? Is that a thing you do? Because it's not a thing I do. And let me tell you that.
Well, for languages that I'm really interested and passionate about, I say yes. So, for example, I've wrote Python for a lot of time. So when I heard that someone is going to kill Python, I was like, let me see who that person is.
Let's see what about this.
Yeah. Yeah, so I literally went to their website, early access, bird, blah, blah, put my email there, and then I got access.
Yeah.
And then, just made some prints. I don't feel that this language is going to be for me, but if it takes off, I know about it now.
Yeah, I can imagine. Interesting. And you keep tabs on like what happens in the ecosystem as well? Like, how do you keep tabs? Do you have newsletters? You're on Reddit a lot? Something
Reddit,
like that?
Definitely. Yeah. I don't subscribe to newsletters, but Reddit definitely is a way to get the latest info.
That's it for me. We should do a poll in our unit to see how many people like keep tabs on stuff on Reddit or if people do newsletters and stuff like that.
I know I got addicted to Reddit when I randomly started putting on my Google search, like, brackets with Reddit at the end. So, because now I trust this community. I know they have really nice, diverse answers with multiple points of view. So I literally do it now in my Google search.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because it's like I feel like Reddit's kind of a decentralized form of information gathering. And then because of the discussions, it also has like a quality level attached to it. If it gets a lot of upvotes or there's a lot of like controversy, you're like, ooh, what is this? Might be interesting to know of, or it might be of high quality. And then it pops up and you read it.
Now the question is, why do you think Facebook, for example, is not Reddit-ish? Because you have posts, you have comments, you have people who can like, you can actually put angry now on the comments, so you can show positive or negative reactive to anything that is put there.
Yeah.
But we don't feel the same about positive as a base, about Facebook as a base of knowledge, like we think about Reddit.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know Facebook that well. Like I was never on Facebook. I've never had a Facebook account, if that makes sense in any case. But Reddit, for me, it was more so anonymous. You don't have any images. There's no, you don't know who that person is. And therefore their voice versus another voice is just the same, right? Because it's a voice. And the people that are well-spoken in written form, they maybe get upvoted. That's higher quality. But it's not about their looks. I think the anonymity of it plays a big factor. And in Facebook, there's a person there. And a person that has a controversial opinion all of a sudden is putting themselves in a vulnerable position. So they might not do that. They might more conform on the norm that is out there already.
Yeah.
And I don't think on Reddit that's the case.
I think the point you mentioned is very good, which is like giving equal vote for everybody because no one knows anyone.
Yeah.
Another point is, now that you mentioned being anonymous, which is a very good point, I think when I read a comment on Reddit, I don't think about the person who wrote it as like someone is seeking credit for that or credibility because I don't even know who that person is.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, if you have the same comment coming from a person with a name and then a photo on a post, you might think, that guy probably is, acting self-righteous or trying to preach something.
And judge them a lot based how they look, based on their history, something like that.
Yeah, probably that might be the reason indeed.
Yeah, and whenever I'm talking about something I saw on Reddit, I never know the name. I don't know who's behind it. I always say a person on Reddit wrote something.
OP.
Exactly. That's it. The original. Yeah. The OP. Yeah. That's very interesting though. I don't know where it's trending, but there was this thing. I don't know if you've seen it on subreddits. They're making it a lot harder to use, for example, the AI chatbots that they have to automate some stuff on Reddit. All of a sudden they need to pay now. And those communities are kind of, well, you can say endangered because they don't have the money or the time to then actually put in the effort and uphold the same level of quality.
Yeah.
There's like a few days, they call it like a dark something that people agree, okay, on these days we're not going to post. There's not going to be any traffic. Yeah. And it's going around on subreddits now.
So you mean the bots that moderate sometimes the subreddits?
I'm not quite sure, but some communities will have to pay for something they don't have to pay right now.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's kind of a protest. I saw a lot of subreddits post like, okay, this is what's going to happen. No one is going to interact. There's going to be nothing.
Is that a Reddit strike or something?
I think so. Yeah. It was like, I'll show you after, actually. Yeah. It's like across multiple subreddits. Nice. I don't know when it's happening, but I don't expect I'll see a lot of posts there.
but come on. Like, I see some random bots on Reddit, and I'm like someone is hosting this bot.
Yeah.
The idea of the whole bot is literally to crawl Reddit and see if someone wrote paid with P-A-Y-E-D or wrote it with P-A-I-D. And then I'm like...
Yeah,
like,
and I'll correct you for
someone is paying for that.
Yeah, no, I agree. But there's a lot of cool stuff as well. I'm trying to think of an example. I mean, it's like if posts get created to categorize them or to archive them in a certain way,
label.
So they're more findable in that way. Those are the more like simple examples I've seen. I'm on a lot of like anime subreddits. So when a new episode gets posted, they make like a discussion post immediately. And people go in there and discuss things. I love that. I love reading. I don't really post though. But yeah, that's kind of my Reddit experience.
I post when I have questions.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
So yeah, if I am moving to a country, Netherlands, for example, when I came here, just went to subreddit Netherlands. And then I was like...
That's the
this
one.
This is my salary package. I intend to live here and there.
Yeah.
And yeah, what do you think? Would it work? Am I going to make it? And then you hear all kinds of the spectrum of people since like xenophobic till, I don't know.
Yeah,
like, it's a wide gonna range. Work.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really nice.
Did you get some good advice though through that?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, actually. About like where to live at least at first, where to find the first apartment, which places not to look for apartment to not get scammed.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
That's good. Really good stuff. And where'd you live before?
Brazil.
Brazil.
Yeah.
From when to when, actually? Like all your childhood?
Not really. The last time I went to Brazil is on university. So yep. 2014 till the end of university. And then COVID happened.
Yeah.
And then I started traveling around the world.
That's
basically
awesome.
In COVID. I got locked down in Jordan.
Okay.
For like 1 year and a half.
Yeah. So that's a long period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. That was really, really funny. I like bought tickets to travel for 1 week or 2 weeks to Jordan.
Yeah.
And then when I bought the ticket, COVID was not the thing.
Okay.
It was like October 2019. So no one was really talking about it seriously. But the tickets were for March 2020, which is when things started happening.
Yeah, exactly.
So I traveled. I was like, yeah, I'm not going to cancel my ticket. People are saying that it's not that big of an issue.
Yeah.
And then it's really funny because I was like, I traveled from Brazil to the UK and then from the UK to Poland, from Poland to Jordan.
Hmm.
And it was literally me landing in a country, spending some time seeing some things, 1 or 2 days, and then country declaring lockdown.
Yeah.
And me like having to run to another country because... It was really, at that time, Italy was being the most dangerous one.
Yeah.
And yeah, I remember, I think I left Poland like 3 or 4 hours before they literally declared total lockdown.
That's
no
insane.
Flights.
That's insane. You could have been locked down in Poland.
Yeah. And it would have been 6 months.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I went to Jordan and 5 days after I arrived, I was supposed to stay for 2 weeks and then go back to Brazil.
Yeah.
5 days after I arrived, and then it's like a lockdown, and went on for months without any flights.
Getting out. That's insane. kind of crazy. Were you working at the time as well? Like yeah. For the same company?
Yeah.
Or different companies?
Yeah, I used to work remotely even before COVID. So I was working for the Brazilian Adyen. It's a payment processing company.
Nice.
And yeah, I used to work remotely from Brasilia. They are based on Rio de Janeiro.
Yeah.
So yeah, it wasn't really a big deal if I'm working in Brasilia or if I'm working on the other side of the world. I'm not in the office anyways.
Exactly.
So it was okay as long as I am in the commercial hours of Brazil. So I had like 1 year of working till midnight.
Damn. I was going to ask. Yeah, that's a rough one actually.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think it was a nice experience. Yeah.
It's different for sure. Yeah.
While being locked down.
Couldn't go anywhere anyway. Yeah, exactly. Nice. Now that you've kind of, I mean, you've moved to NL, like is the work experience different culture-wise? Or is it similar to what you had in Brazil?
I would say there are similar things and there are different things. I've also worked in a company based in Jordan.
Yeah.
I've also provided services to a company based in the US. And then you widen your spectrum a lot about differences.
I can imagine. Yeah.
And but about your question, NL in Brazil specifically, I would say yes. Hmm. And it is less different than other countries comparing between each other. So of course it's different, but you have bigger gaps if you compare other cultures between each other.
What would you say like the biggest gap is in between which countries?
Funny enough, I would say the US and Europe.
Really? Yeah. Okay.
I would say their approach to work, work-life balance, like work ethics is totally different.
Like so even US is more like stringent and Europe is more relaxed because that's what I hear.
I think it also depends on the country in Europe.
Yeah.
But I've always heard like Americans complaining about Europeans not working enough.
Yeah. Having too many holidays.
Yeah. And then I've always heard Europeans saying that Americans act as if they are working a lot. But they are always drinking coffee on the coffee machine.
Yeah.
So it's always both sides of the coin, but I would say it's the biggest gap that I saw is between these two work ethics and work-life balances.
Mm. Did your own work style or work-life balance change also because of that? Because you're kind of in an environment and you're kind of holding the culture they have.
Yeah, I am pro-immersion. So I don't like to, of course, there are always your personal boundaries and like things that you would never let go of.
Yeah.
But on the things that are negotiable, on like your work style, your, I don't know, work-life balance, I am totally pro looking how it works here and then trying it out.
Yeah.
Especially if you think about it as joining a new team. I think every single team is different. They have their own style, their own, even their own culture, depending on the composition of the team.
Yeah.
And generally, if you join a team, probably you will have to adapt to the team style.
Yeah. Exactly.
And then just scale it up and then adapt to the work-life balance of the country or the work style of the country or the culture of the country.
Yeah. I don't have that many experiences. Like from a consultancy point of view, you go to different organizations, but they've always been, I think they've always been NL based. There was one that was more international. It was based in the UK, I guess. And I built a platform that was going to go live in Japan, but the people I interacted with were still the people in NL or the UK in that aspect. So I never actually got more so immersed in the work culture of somewhere abroad. But I do think it could be interesting. It can be an interesting perspective.
Think about it this way. Only 14 paid time to take holidays.
Yeah.
Only 14 days.
That's rough.
Yeah.
That's
this is, I would say, the norm in the US.
Yeah.
So this is, if you don't even need to know about that amount of hours. Yeah. You don't need to know about the work style. About when do you receive an email and when are you expected to answer that email?
Mm.
Just like your vacations is enough indication on how to compare the different work styles.
Yeah, exactly. And the customer I'm working with now, they told me how many vacation days? 38. And I was like, what? Because then you do the calculation and you're like, that's like 7 weeks. That's more than 7 weeks. Plus you have public holidays. Like that's a good deal.
Yeah.
It's like, that's a good deal.
I think ASML was like 40 days.
Really?
Yeah.
That's insane. Like, I think it says a lot when the number is like 38 or 40 rather than unlimited. Because with unlimited, that's all of a sudden like, oh, if you take a holiday, people look at you. Oh, you're taking a holiday. Oh, okay. Interesting.
You're taking advantage of the system.
Exactly. Like you're using that unlimited? And I'm like, I'm using that unlimited. What do you mean? No, apparently people look at you weird then. So I don't know if it's a tactic.
I've never seen this proposal of unlimited PTO here in the Netherlands?
I think, I don't think they have it. I was going to say Microsoft has it, but I don't think they do.
I've only seen it in the US, actually. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
And yeah, I've seen some researches showing the average...
No one takes holidays anymore.
No, not like no one takes holidays anymore, but no one is taking more holidays than before after.
Yeah, some dangerous stuff. Yeah, but it sounds good. It's like you get a choice. You want unlimited or you want like a fixed amount? You're like unlimited. Except when it actually happens and you feel kind of this yeah, how do you say that? Hurdle to actually take holidays then.
Maybe the question is you want unlimited holidays or you want a raise?
Yeah, that could be as well. I'll take a raise. Yeah. That'd be funny if you had the option. Yeah. But before we spoke, and you said in uni you didn't actually do like software engineering. Were you a mechanical engineer or electrical?
Mechatronics. Yeah.
So you built robots and stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, literally.
Any of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Competed internationally, won awards.
What robot did you build?
So many of them. I think in total I've built more than 9 functioning robots.
Yeah.
But the highlights were a robot that was a firefighter. So basically, you have a maze that that can have different compositions.
Mm.
And then you'll need to build a totally autonomous robot. So it's not like controlled by you.
Yeah.
The robot should be intelligent enough to navigate through the maze. But also the robot should find a fire source and then put the fire down. And you could get points to put the fire down through wind. So just by blowing air on it. But also you could get more points if you use water, which is more realistic to real life fires.
Yeah.
So if you choose water, of course, you're going to get into more complexities, which is like making your robot waterproof because you'll have water in it and you don't want to get screwed. And we're not like using pre-built stuff. We're literally like making 3D modeling of the devices and then of the structure of the robot and then making all the electronical designs, printing them out and then using them. And any drop of water can make a huge mess.
Yeah. You did the modeling as well?
Yeah. So we were... a team.
Yeah.
More people were more specialized in the mechanical part. More people are more specialized in the mechanical part, electronics. And there are some people that are more specialized in the programming. I've always enjoyed more programming.
Okay.
So I was more into programming these robots, embedded programming. So C and C++.
Yeah.
But yeah, for many of them, I was also totally involved in the electronics and in the mechanics because I've been the captain of one of the teams.
Okay.
And then you had to really put everything together and try to help everybody in any issue that appears.
Yeah. Why did you move away from that? Because if I were to tell my younger self, like, you can either build robots or like the stuff that we do now, like consultancy, you go to clients, solve their problems, they'll probably pick the robots.
I think the way you put it is the problem. It's not really the different applications. Explain it to a kid as like, okay, a robot, but then you explain it as, okay, I'm going to build you a magic box that make you choose something from your home and then get your game or your toy in the next day at your door.
Yeah.
And then you don't need to worry about that. And then automatically it's like, I don't know, Santa Claus appears on your door and then you have it.
Exactly.
They might be interested on that, which is e-com basically.
Yeah.
So it depends on how you sell it to the kid, I would say.
That's a good point.
My point is I liked robotics and that firefighter robot, we got the 3rd place worldwide for it. So we did some really nice stuff on that.
Nice.
I've never seen myself looking like at that and thinking, yeah, now I'm going to let go of robotics and then I'll do consultancy.
Yeah.
I've always been like, yeah, I'm in that situation and what is the best move? So I worked in a payment processor in Brazil, as I said, and they had many hardware devices. So it has to do with what I've been doing, right? It has hardware, you need to put the payment card and then it's a POS machine. It takes the money out of the card, processes it, and then gets it to the store owner.
Yeah.
That had to do with robotics somehow because it's an embedded device. But that also has a bridge to e-com because you are paying for something.
Yeah.
And this is how it went. So from the payment processing stuff, I got into e-com and then started working on that. But I've never let go of robotics, for example. In my house, I have some IoT projects to, I don't know, measure temperature, turn on lights, turn off lights, automate some stuff. So Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. I like that you highlight that you never let go of your previous experience in any case, right? Because the experience that you've had, you leverage, and you can even leverage that in a subsequent assignment or project or job, doesn't matter really. The experience that you've had, you leverage that and you take that with you. It's not wasted experience, is what I was going at.
Especially when you talk about Go.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Pointers, compiled language, like it has totally to do with these other languages that you would use on robots in general.
Yeah. You think you'll ever go back then to more so embedded or IoT in that case?
I don't, I wouldn't say I'll never go back to that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I will, but maybe in my own company, I would do something with that.
Yeah. You're going to start your own company?
I think one day I will.
That's good. Hopefully. I say that as well. Yeah. It's on there now. I'm not the only one that has said it.
Want to be my partner in company?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. We can start. Do you have ideas? Like, do you write down? Because I sometimes do that. I'm like, ooh, that's it. And I write, make a little note.
Well.
You don't have to share them. They're really good ideas.
It's not like, it's not about sharing. I'm trying to find the best adult way to put that.
Uh-huh.
So I used to really, really like put a lot of value on ideas and like think this is my idea. I'm going to take a note of it and then no one will see it.
Yeah.
And then I think I got, I don't know, mature enough to really appreciate more execution than just the idea. And I think engineers in general struggle in the execution, and that's where the joy comes from. It's in the journey and not really into who had the idea. Of course, if you have a brilliant idea, it can become something big. But what really makes it happen is the execution. Yeah. And for me, that's why I don't really think about ideas of business anymore as like intellectual property that I need to take a note and hide it and stuff. Nowadays, I actually give random ideas and talk about them, and I would be super happy to see them implemented.
Yeah.
Even if it was by other people, I would be really happy to see that because I will appreciate all the effort that they put into making it happen.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's I've had a similar train of thought that I thought the idea was the gold, but it's not the gold, right? If you're thinking about success, is it success when you achieve something, or is it success because you enjoy the ride and then you can achieve anything, right? That makes someone successful, I feel like, rather than the achievements or the accolades that other people put on them. But that's not really what people talk about.
I would say both.
Yeah.
I think like for auto satisfaction, of course, you need to enjoy the ride.
Yeah.
And you need to really like what you're doing. But for me also, it is important to see the results of that impacting other people's life.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are limiting it only to enjoying the ride, think about a product you build, I don't know, it takes you 1 year to build it.
Yeah.
You build 90%. You're like on the 10th month or like 11th month.
Yeah.
And then, okay, you had literally 10 months of pure joy because you like what you are doing.
Mm-hmm.
But from my end, I would feel, okay, I would like the 10 months that I did. But then part of my joy will be when I finish the 12 months, put it live and see people using it and seeing that the application or the robot or whatever I did literally impacted positively someone's life.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. But there's a downside to that as well, right? And I can use like social media or YouTube even as an example. If with the podcast, if I get more listeners, I used to be like, look, more listeners is really good, right? But then all of a sudden you're like, I thought 100 listeners was a lot. I was like, who chimes in? 100 people chime into this episode, for example? Like, that is ridiculous. And then it raises the bar. And all of a sudden, the initial 100 doesn't seem like a lot anymore because we're looking at a different number, a higher number. And it always needs to be higher, right? And I like a higher number. And all of a sudden, no. It needs to be even high. Why wasn't that that high? Well, we already reached the 100. Like, we're already past that. You want this kind of higher high and continuous higher high. And you get disappointed if you go a little bit below that. Like, there's only an onwards and upwards. And if you fall below that, if you hold value to that, it can actually hit you.
And they call that like, greed.
Yeah, it could be greed. I think it has a lot to do with dopamine. Like, I'm not an expert, but I think it's like a dopamine spike.
Yeah.
But in any case, I've decided to kind of more so detach myself from this and be proud of what we put out. For example, this episode, I'm going to be proud of because I like this dynamic. I like this conversation. And the previous episodes, I have different sets of values that I uphold and the quality in there as well. So I can be proud of those things. I'm more so proud of the journey that it is still continuing rather than the numbers that are there and on there that can vary. And in that way, I think I enjoy more so the process now rather than the numbers that are the output of that.
That's the point. What I was trying to say is what you closed with. Yeah. You said, I enjoy more. Yeah. You didn't say, I enjoy only.
Exactly.
So if you enjoy more the process, I think you are doing it perfectly. If you are only doing it for the numbers, you're doing it probably wrong. Yeah. You're not going to continue with it.
No, I think it's going to be very disheartening if the numbers go down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if you are doing it for the process and you enjoy it, you can keep on doing it.
Yeah.
But you didn't say only for the process.
That's true.
There is always a component into results, but I don't think it's healthy to expand that component too much and then keep on thinking about it. I think it's healthy to keep it in mind.
Yeah.
Also as a measure of your performance, how you are doing, and at the same time, enjoy what you are doing.
I agree. I think if you're not, like we're talking about results oriented, I guess, I don't know what you would be if you don't really think about results. Are you then kind of a loose cannon and it can go anywhere? Because I feel like having an eye on results, even though you can have kind of a detached value on there, still allows for a certain amount of focus, a certain amount of kind of goals that you have on those results. It can be output, because usually numbers are output, not necessarily outcomes. But in any case, I think it can be good to keep those in mind as well.
I think it depends on how you define results.
Yeah.
So you can make your compass or your direction always into more joy. And then you would like record a podcast and then film it, go out and try to, okay, how happy I feel now.
Yeah.
How joyful it was. And then based on that, try doing more of that stuff or less of that stuff.
Yeah.
But then will that be sustainable? I don't know. But you can use it as a result, of course.
Yeah.
Measuring your own happiness in that journey.
Yeah, it could be. Like the funny thing is, after conversations like this, after a whole day, maybe it's because of the day and the conversations, but I am tired. I am exhausted. I don't want to talk anymore. Like if I go home, I actually don't want to talk that much anymore. And two, I can handle two on a day, like episodes like these. Two is a good day. Three is a max. Because then after the third one, I'm like, oh my God, wipe me away. Like I'm done. I'm exhausted.
Introvert vibes.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah. And then I re-listen to them and I get a lot of joy out of them. I'm like, this was actually really good. And you don't notice it, but it can be really
good. Nice.
Yeah. And then I get that kind of sense of fulfillment again and be like, yeah, this is why we do it, basically. Or I can see, man, I was exhausted. I shouldn't do three anymore.
That's a really good example of a result that you can use to change your path in your podcast.
Yeah.
And it's not numbers.
Yeah.
You're just hearing yourself and you can see, okay, I wasn't really enjoying that moment. I was exhausted.
I have that a lot, yeah.
And then based on that, okay, next time probably I'm not going to do three in one day.
Yeah.
And that was not numbers at all. That was part of the journey also.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah. And I keep doing that. I feel like if you're not doing that with something that you really love or are passionate about, maybe you've lost then that sense of love or passion. Because I feel like I'm always, whenever I do something, and I do it for a long, long time, like I used to play a lot of video games on my mobile phone, and I would do that for years. I also did my thesis on that. I'll tell you that after the show, actually. It was a lot on Reddit. That's why. Yeah. But in any case, I would try and be better at it. I would go to subreddits and really try and hone that. And when that part of it was gone, I feel like I lost interest. That's probably why I also kind of sold my account and quit at the end of the day, because I lost that sense of passion. And I feel like with whatever you do, you need to have kind of this innate kind of drive of making it better or kind of reaching fulfillment. And fulfillment can be in anything.
Some dopamine.
You need to have that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You need to find a healthy balance.
I would say many things that we do, if we do them a lot, end up turning into a habit.
Yeah.
And maybe if it's not something that is really adding a lot of value to your life as a habit, after 1 or 2 years of doing it like frequently every day, you'll be like, okay, like why am I doing that anymore? So for example, let's talk about, I don't know, funny habits, going to the gym, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I would say if you do it at first, you might be the type of person who would get like hyped up. I went to the gym. I feel really better. I like it.
Yeah.
I'm doing it because it makes me feel better. And then you do it enough every day for like some years. And then eventually it turns into a habit and then you don't think a lot of about it. But then you know it's beneficial, so you don't let go of it.
Yeah.
But if you think about a video game, at first it was giving you really some nice moments. You were liking it, getting some emotions out of it. And then afterwards it turned into a habit because you did it so much. But then when it became a habit, you looked at it and I'm like, why am I doing this anymore? It's a habit and it's not adding any value for me. I'm not really getting a lot of...
It could be. Like I also like doing things because they give me a certain sense of fulfillment. I think that's the part. Like, it doesn't have to benefit you, like your life maybe, I guess. Because I still enjoy playing video games. Like, they make me happy. And I don't know if it has to do again with dopamine, but they give me fulfillment in a certain way. And I know it's not really going to add anything to my real life or anything. Maybe it makes me think more so strategically about things. I have no clue what the added benefit
of it
is.
You can go to an e-sport event.
Exactly.
Compete.
No, really lay out some stuff, actually. That's some interesting stuff. Yeah. I used to be the number two in Europe.
Oh!
I never got number one. But in any case, where was I going with that? I think it's fine to do things that you just enjoy, that give you a certain sense of fulfillment. And I think some people also kind of can over-optimize their life. If they're like, oh, I'm not watching that Netflix show because it's not making me smarter or anything. Then I'm like, man, okay. Fun to hang around with you.
Yeah. I really liked to be around you, man.
Yeah, exactly.
Next week I'll be busy.
Yeah. Like, I don't think everything needs to be over-optimized. You can do things because you like them.
Yeah. My point about that would be, it's really hard to think about something that gives you like instant joy and think that you will continue getting that instant joy forever doing that thing.
Yeah.
All over again and again and again.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's my point about it. If it's not giving you that joy anymore, probably it is a habit.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. I wish everyone that experience, that they can have that joy and have it over and over and over again.
Do you feel like you have something in your life in which you've been doing for like years? And
I mean, the podcast is the only example that comes to mind. I love doing the podcast, not just because, like, if it was the same, I think it would be boring. But because it gives me a lot of opportunities to have conversations like these, it kind of fulfills this sense of curiosity that I have. And I just really enjoy doing it and then re-listening to it even. Maybe it's because I've always listened to podcasts and enjoyed that. But I feel like even having the sense that I can still improve this gives me a lot of fulfillment and that I can see that it can go better and that we get better feedback also.
Yeah. It also has a human part in it, right?
Yeah.
Every podcast that you record or film, it's with someone new with a totally different background, and then it's a whole different journey, and then you get different kinds of joy out of it, I would say.
Yeah. For me, it's also in a way like a cheat code, because these conversations, sometimes you don't have them in real life.
Yeah.
And sometimes I meet someone who I've only seen in real life physically when I'm doing the podcast. And all of a sudden you go deep in a conversation and you're like, okay, I know this side of someone now. And someone who they might be friends with don't even know about like this side of them. Or they might not even have realized like the way sometimes the conversation flows. I'm like, oh, this is what I'm actually thinking. Interesting. Because I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's the joy of podcasting. But right. I think I talk about podcasts way too much. I think that's a sign that we need to round it off.
Okay.
Thanks so much for coming on, man. This was a blast. Was this kind of what you thought was going to happen?
I didn't come with expectations, actually.
No expectations.
And for the ride, and it was really nice.
Was it a nice surprise?
Yeah.
Good stuff. Cool. Then I'm going to round it off here, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Abdullah Zaitar, I'm going to put all his socials in the description below. Check him out. Let him know you came from our show. And with that being said, thank you for listening. We'll see you on the next one.